This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. This conversation took place at our 2018 Tribeca Film Festival. It's part of our Storyteller series, where we celebrate multi-hyphenates in film, TV, and music. Tribeca's CEO and co-founder, Jane Rosenthal, kicked it off.
So tonight you're really in for a treat. Jamie Foxx has attained unprecedented achievements as an actor, producer, comedian, and musician. He won an Academy Award, Golden Globe, and BAFTA for his portrayal of musician Ray Charles in the 2004 biopic Ray. He's only the third man in history to receive two acting Oscar nominations in the same year for two different roles. He's also a Grammy Award-winning musician. I'm thrilled to have him here today and to join him in conversation. We're excited to have another storyteller, genius news anchor Jacques Morel. Everybody, please welcome Jacques Morel and Jamie Foxx.
Thank you, Jane. So, keep it going for Jane.
I just want to start with this one quote, and then we're going to go for it. You once told, I think it was the LA Times, and you said, quote, "I've had a style for a long time, but it's always been stuck into a TV show here or flashed in an interview there. It may be new to you, but not to me." Can you please take me back to your first character?
Was that me?
Yeah, that was you. Prolific.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you take me back to your first character of Eric Marlin Bishop?
I grew up in Terrell, Texas, Eric Marlin Bishop. A lot of people didn't know, Texas person, all right. but I was always like that kid, you know what I mean? I was that kid and I was always sort of destined to do something that was entertaining. And luckily I had a grandmother who sort of recognized that. And I also had teachers who recognized that I was the guy that was going to disrupt class. I was a guy who was, I only had my bedroom was the only room where the TV was. So my grandmother and my grandfather watched Johnny Carson. So I would take the jokes from Johnny Carson and then go to school in like the fourth grade and tell those jokes to the kid like I wrote them, you know. But I was always like, figuring out things on how could I get out of my little bitty town of Terrell, Texas, population 12,240, and come be in front of these beautiful people in New York City. New York City.
Wait, you want more?
Well,
no, actually, I want to talk about your grandmother real quick.
Yeah, Estelle Talley.
You have once said that your grandmother has like a natural intelligence.
My grandmother,
and actually, I want to go in one story specifically because she actually stood up to a pastor in church one time.
Yeah, there was a situation. You know, we was young, man. I didn't know stuff about stuff, but my grandmother had a nursery school, and so she, for 30 years, she raised the city. So there was a situation where the pastor was preaching about gay people. And, I'm 9 or 10, so we didn't know what gay meant. We thought it was like happy. You know what I'm saying? We know what that meant. And so the preacher was saying, God made Adam and Eve. He didn't make Adam and Steve, right? And then my grandmother stood up and said, You stop that. God made sissies too. Just the way she talked, God made sissies too. You stop that. You apologize. And she stopped him from saying that. And we didn't know what that meant at that time. But my grandmother explained to me, she says, listen, I had a nursery school. And so I would raise these young boys and girls. Some of the boys would like to play with army men. Some of them would play with dolls. And says a lot of those kids who were growing up in Texas, a place where it is racially defined a lot of things that were, taboo at that time. This is like 1976. She said, I raised those kids, and some of those kids would come and confide in me the things that they were going through. So she stood up for them, and I just, I commended her. As I got old, I said, she was really a revolutionary.
Yeah. Could you please clap it up for that? Yeah. And the thing that I think is amazing is your grandmother, taught you...
She taught me everything.
She forced you to learn piano, and then
she made me play classical piano And for one, I wanted to do it because my older brother played the piano. He'd always had girls, you know, like he played the piano, girls be sitting. I said, man, what are you doing in here with them girls? And my grandmother said, I want you to learn how to play classical piano. And she said, because it'll take you across the tracks. And what that means is, you know, in my southern town, you know, the tracks was like separated the town from the black and the white. So I thought she meant, Granny, you want me to learn how to play the piano so I can play on the white side of town? She was like, no. It's metaphor. Metaphorically, you'll be able to go anywhere in the world and show your music. And classical piano, she thought, was the greatest medium to do that. And I ended up going from Terrell, Texas to United States International University playing classical music. And it was 81 different countries represented in my school with music, which was crazy to me because, you know, I grew up in Terrell where it was just black, whites, and Mexicans, where it was just, you know, it was a simplified, you know, you just, you knew who everybody was, you know, but when you get to like United States International University, I saw a brother, I'd be like, what's up, brother? He go, bonjour. I say, what? What part of Texas is that? Bonjours. Oh, you see white, I thought it was a white guy. What's that? Puerto Rico, San Angelito. Oh, where are you from? Argentina. Where is that in Texas? So that having her have the insight or the foresight to have me play the music, I got a chance to learn the world, you know?
And it's actually kind of funny because you said there were 80 different countries.
81 different countries.
And in your interview with Tim Ferriss, I don't know if anybody's had a chance, but you guys should definitely listen to it. It's amazing. You had said that you were kind of the spackle between white and black.
Yeah, what it was that when I got to college, like, you know, I'm just a fun dude from Texas, and I remember I didn't know what Jewish was. I didn't know what Palestinian, because in Texas, you know, we study Texas history. You get a book, it's Texas. If it didn't happen in Texas, it didn't happen. So I knew who Martin Luther King was, but I didn't know who Malcolm X was. I thought Malcolm X was like the dude from Speed Racer. Racer X, Speed Racer X. Anybody remember Racer X? Y'all acting like I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to tell you that Racer X was your brother, Speed, but I didn't know how to tell you that he was. So I didn't know those things. And so I had a great education of humans. And in the student center, there was an argument. These two dudes was arguing about the Gaza Strip. And I'm like, is it a strip club? I don't know. What is it, a strip club? Why don't they just, I don't know what they're talking about. And then when they explained to me what it was, I was of the mindset, because we were all there for music, hey man, let's get together and play music. So we would get together and we would grab our instruments, and I would play the piano and they would play the violins or whatever, and we started all coming together as music. So they called me Spackle. And do you know what Spackle is? Spackle is the stuff that you guys have never worked that kind of job. It's well, what is this Spackle? Is that, no, it's the is that a regular job or no? I'm just saying, spackle is the stuff that goes between the bricks that holds them together. And so that's what I was. I would have everybody come hang out at my dorm and we'd all play. And I said, I don't know about all that, but I know the music brings us together. Let the music bring us together. It's the music.
Jamie Foxx, everybody.
Music bring us together. See, that's the other thing too. Like growing up playing that music, I knew how I could get that music off. Like I used to like mimic Lionel Richie back in the day. You know, Lionel. We call him Lionel Richie. And take, cause I had the curl just like him. It was low in the front and long in the back. Looked like a Z-28 from the side.
So
hello. Is it me you're looking for? Mama say, mama say, mama makusa.
Hey.
Wakanda.
Tribeca, y'all. How y'all feeling tonight? So you're in the West Coast.
Yes.
But there's an interesting story as to how you became Jamie Foxx as compared to Eric Marlon Bishop.
Yeah, a lot of millennials flipped out when they found out my name was Eric Bishop. They're like, I can't believe this. He's disrespected us. He's a charlatan. Hashtag misled. Hashtag this is some bullshit. Hashtag. I'm like, get the fuck out. Get the fuck out of here with your young ass. Learn some shit with your young ass. You young motherfuckers don't know shit. I was taking a picture with the young black fella back there. He was taking my picture. He didn't know who Lou Gossett was. Damn it, bring him out. String him up. He didn't know who Lou Gossett was with y'all young asses. Lou Gossett also won an Oscar and Officer and a Gentleman. Go check it out. Anyway, but yeah, Eric Bishop is my real name, but when I first got to L.A., I was going up doing stand-up. Like, when I was in college, like, when I was 18 years old, I would go, like, to the comedy clubs, and I couldn't get in the club because I was too young, but they would let me wait outside the club and then bring me on. I'd do my jokes, and then they'd kick me out of the club. So every time I'd be at the club outside, like, you know, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. So I went on an open mic night, got a standing ovation. This is in L.A., and when I went on, I had to check out the lay of the land first, because it was on Monday nights, a lot of gang members was in the audience. And I didn't understand that either, because I didn't know what a Crip and a Blood was. I just know they had on blue and red. I was like, why they got the same colors on? I thought it was like a majorette or something. I don't know what it was. So I knew that if I went up, all of the Crips that were in the audience, I had to sort of make good with them. So I would go on stage and do impersonations, but I would do impersonations as if I was a Crip. So I would go on stage and do like Mike Tyson, I'm Crippin', whatever. Crip. And they'd be like, oh yeah, cub, we love him, cub. And at that time, I was the only black dude doing a Ronald Reagan. I was like, well, as a matter of fact, I'm a Crip. Anyway, so doing that, I get this standing ovation, right? And, after I come off, I'm thinking everything is going to go great. But now every time I came back to that club, they wouldn't let me on, because you would have to sign your name on the list, and the comedians ran the list. So every time they saw Eric Bishop, they wouldn't put me on. So 6 weeks go by, I can't get on stage. So I ended up going to Santa Monica Improv when they were having Evening at the Improv at that time. And I noticed that 100 guys would show up, and then it would only be like 4 or 5 girls. So what I did was grab the list and I wrote down unisex names: Stacey Brown, Tracy Green, Jamie Foxx. So the dude grabs the list and says, all right, we're going to start it off. First person will be up is Jamie Foxx. Is she here? I'm like, hey. I'm Iz. So anyway, and at that time they were shooting a TV show called Evening at the Improv. I don't know if you remember that, but I was part of the fresh meat, meaning that I was the people that they were going to put on and basically fail because they didn't know who I was, but I was ready for that ass, right? So they put me on and they bring me up in a sweet spot, and I end up getting a standing ovation as Jamie Foxx, and that's how the legend was born.
Hey. And
they thought I was stuck up. They thought I was stuck up, too, because after I had a great set, they were yelling my name, Jamie, but I wasn't used to the name. So people saying, yo, what's up, Jamie? I ain't looking at him. Like, oh, man, it's Jamie. I'm like, what's up? So I said, he's stuck up, because I wasn't used to that name yet. But that's how, you know, Jamie started.
That's lovely. I think one thing that also furthered, like, and also, like, led into the spackle idea too, right? You know, let's stick with that for a second.
Weave it.
You used social media, but in 1994, as a way to further your career by throwing parties, but you used cue cards in a unique way.
Oh, I was the first person to do social media. Like, I know it sounds weird, but I was the original. All you young motherfuckers, I was already doing that shit. Hashtag, I'm first. What happened was is that I didn't have a clique. I didn't have a crew in L.A., and everybody had a clique. The Wayans had a crew. It was like 9,000 of them, and it was all these other. It was like 95,000 Wayans. It was a gang of them motherfuckers, and they were all funny. I'm like, well, my haircut looked like them, but I'm not with them. So what happened was every time I did a show, like if I did a show for you guys, I had cue cards, and I would pass the cue cards out, and I would have people sign their name and put their pager number on there. Remember
what's
the
pager?
The page. Break it down. The pager. You know
pager?
What I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's the pager when you walk in. Oh shit! You have to. You don't want to take it off your belt because you lose the motherfucker. So you just trying to read that bitch. Who the fuck is this calling? You know what I'm saying? So, you see, y'all old heads know what I'm talking about. So I would have them, I would page them and let them know, I would page them as Eric Bishop and say, hey, come see me in the club. Friday, whatever, whatever. And so I would do that. And so I had 800 signatures. 600 of them were women, because women would love to come to the comedy clubs. The guys would love to come to watch the women at the comedy clubs. And so it was crazy. So anyway, so I had 800 signatures, and I would call people and say, hey, I'm going to be at Comedy Act Theater. 100 people would show up. Club owner says, you're not going on. I said, but I called 100 people. I don't care what you call. So I would page the next time, say, don't go in unless you say, is Jamie Foxx going on? And then that way, I get a chance to get my spot, right? So I started doing that. And then that 600 or 800 signatures became my floating list for anything I wanted to do. So when I wanted to throw a party at the beach, which didn't cost no money, because the beach, it did everything for you, the water and the sand and shit, that's everything. Look at the water. Don't worry about it. Drink this water while you look at the water. I don't have enough to buy a drink, but drink this water and look at that water. So it became like my floating party list that I still have those names to this day, and that was 30 years ago.
Wow. And in the spackle idea, your first party.
Leave it, Jacques.
Well, I'm doing it, right? And the first party was, what is it, Halloween 94.
Wow.
And you were excited for, what's his name, Wesley Snipes to show up. But you had all these celebrities there, all these people there. You, again, being the spackle, just connecting all these people, these different people together.
What happened was I became a local celebrity in L.A., but I wasn't on. So I would go to, like, the Roxbury Club. I can't get in the Roxbury, but I was great on the other side of the street, like, yelling people's names. Like, Bruce Willis, come out, Bruce Willis! Oh, Bruce Willis right there. And I would always see Wesley Snipes, and I know he hated me because I was always, Wesley Snipes! And then I would do lines from his movies. Huh, is that what this is about? Huh, huh, huh. Over a fucking skeezer? Huh, Wesley! New Jack City, baby! Wesley Snipes! And you know, black people, when we get really excited, like one day I actually snuck onto the other side of the street of the Roxbury because the security was always like, get out the way. I'm like, man, that ain't your club, man. Let me live, man. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Security act like, you ain't never even been in the club, dog. Let me live, dog. I'm just trying to see Wesley Snipes. And then Denzel walked out that motherfucker and I was like, shit. And you know, black people, when we get excited, we march. You know what I'm saying? I saw Denzel. I was like, oh. So I saw Denzel. I was like, I can't fucking believe this dude is like 2 feet in front of me in the flesh. So I rushed him and I grabbed him, and he did some kind of karate shit and hit me right in the throat. Like, hold on, calm down now. Okay, hold on, all right, just hold on, calm down. I see you're excited, all right, you're excited. Calm down, all right, calm down, take a breath. I said, D, I'm just trying to give you your props. I love you, D. So when I did get on, I took that same party list and threw a party. That party you're talking about for the Halloween. And I was just praying that Wesley Snipes would come to my party, because I stalked Wesley. I mean, because I don't know if you've ever been to L.A., but in Venice, like Venice Beach, I saw Wesley Snipes at Venice Beach one time with all his crew, and he had on the same shit he had on in New Jack City. And it was like 1,000 degrees outside. He had on a blue felt hat with that long ass multicolored shirt with them rayon blue shoes and blue slacks in them. And he had something like this, you know, the feet was out, and he had a little towel because he knew it was hot. But he looked great though. And remember when the belt would tie like that and he tied another knot and the belt went down like that? I said, motherfucker, stylish. But it was hot, so he's sitting up in the stands, and I see him in the stands, but I just go around the back because there were bleachers. So I climbed up the back of the bleachers, and I was on the top bleacher, but he down there. And every time somebody scored on the basketball court and they started yelling, I go, boop, down to one bleacher. Great shot! Boop. Oh, damn, block that. Boop. And I'm sitting right next to him. I'm right next to him. And then he said some baller shit. He said, hey, why don't we, he said it to his crew, why don't we go to Gladstone's, get some of those shrimp. I was like, oh, damn, that sound good. I ain't had no money to get no shrimp. But I was like, man, shit. So anyway, I throw this party, Halloween party, and everybody comes. And it was an old school party. Yo-Yo was there. No, I can't live without my yo-yo. Just a gang of people came, and then all of a sudden, this black NS, what is that? The Nissan, what is it called?
NSX.
The NXS, black NXS with some black dude in it. And out popped that motherfucker, was Wesley Snipes at my house party. And he came in, and I made everybody get out of the way, it's Wesley. I was like, what was that movie Al Pacino did? Was it Carlito's Way? No, it's Carlito's Way. I'm arguing with you about this shit. I'm sorry, bro. I mean, I'm asking you for help, and then I just jumped on your shit. Hey, it's Carlito's Way, motherfucker. I don't know what. No. What's my Puerto Rican guy that was in Carlito's Way? John Leguizamo. I turned into John Leguizamo. Get out of the way, you goddamn motherfuckers. It's Wesley. You got to see the movie. That joke would be a lot funnier. Anyway. So Wesley came in and he sat down and he played chess and we all lost. So we could just have that moment of Wesley breaking down what it is to be him. And he was gracious enough to talk to all of us and tell us about, you know, acting and all that kind of stuff. So life was starting out pretty good.
Yeah. So and around this time, you were doing a very special character by the name of Wanda. But before we get into that, talk about how being late to your audition actually got you the job.
What happened was is that I was slaying L.A. I was like the king of L.A. I would come in as a comedian and I would like, it was gunslinger. I come in.
You were dangerous.
I was the coldest, especially if you're this close to me and I'm telling jokes, that could hurt you. Like when I was telling jokes, if you were this close, I was killing, But I wasn't on. Everybody was on Living Color and they were shining. So and Living Color had these auditions and I had tried to be on this show called Rock at first. I get fired from Rock before Rock even came out. I was in the pilot and called everybody internal. I done made it, baby. Wait till you see. And then we didn't see because they cut me out of the pilot. And then my grandma and everybody in the hometown, boy, that boy out there lying. He ain't doing shit. That boy just lying. He ain't worth a shit. He out there doing drugs or something. I was dabbling, but it wasn't getting. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, but so auditions for In Living Color came up. 100 people down to 50. Down to 25, down to 10, down to 5. I'm part of the 5. I'm losing. I'm not good in the process. I remember Sean and Marlon and all those guys just going, yo, Jace, just do your thing. Come on, me and Marlon was talking about what you do. You guys, you do your comedy. Me and Marlon was talking. Marlon, tell him. And I was like, damn, I'm fucking up. And then Keenan said, we're going to do stand-up as opposed to doing a little workshop character thing. I said, oh, shit. That's my shot. So it's only 5 of us doing stand-up. 4 of them don't do stand-up. So I show up late on purpose because they were going to put me on first. So I get there, and this lady, Tamara Roberts, says, where have you been? We're waiting on you. My goodness, you're going to blow this. You got to go last now. I'm like, damn, my bad. And we were doing jokes on the white side of town. What I mean by that is that I started out in the hood. Like I always felt like if I do my jokes in the hood and the hood laugh, I got everybody. Cause I was really leery about doing mainstream comedy because you know, mainstream sometimes will laugh and you know, and you think you're killing and then you go to the hood and they boo your ass. So I started out like at the Comedy Act Theater, So I had my music ready, you know what I'm saying? Cause when you come up, you know, when you come up in the hood, you have your music, you got a soundtrack to come up to, you know what I'm saying? So only this place, when I go up, I give them the tape, and it was a cassette tape, and I had to get it right where I needed. I had to have that bitch start right on the beat.
What was the song?
It was Heavy D's in Effect with More Bounce to the Ounce. So I'm ready, right? So I tell the dude, and then mind you, they're not used to this on this side of town. So when they call my name, I say, hit it. Silence. Nothing. I'm like, hit that shit. Hit it. And he went, all you heard was hit rewind and shit. You know. I'm like, fuck it. So I just go up, I do my thing. I said, fuck it, I go up and I do a bit about it, and I work in, it starts going. And when you talk about the Wanda character, that's where Wanda was born. Because as a matter of fact, as I was doing my act and I'm killing, and I look out and I do this joke where I say, all the beautiful ladies in the house right now, make some noise. Ladies, if you feel beautiful, clap your hands right now. Pretty ladies. Now, all the ugly ladies, make some noise. See what I'm saying? And then I would go, see, it's a girl at that time. Girl, I know he ain't talking about me, girl. Forget all that. I was like, hey. And that's how Wanda was born.
Yeah.
In that audition, standing ovation, and then that's how I got on Living Color.
Woo! And all this time, you're still working on your music. And there was a story where you tracked down Teddy Riley at a show while you were as Wanda?
It was tough. Once I did the Wanda character, that character was like, it took off. Like, you wouldn't believe. And the way that character came about was Keenan said, hey, he would bring a big box. And Keenan was amazing when it came to putting jokes together. This guy's mind was amazing. I learned so much from him. Because you got to think about it. On the Living Color, I was the 8th funniest person walking in. There was Jim Carrey. Clap if you feel it. Damon Wayans, all the Wayans, all those guys, David Alan Greer. I mean, all these guys were, David Alan Greer was amazing. Tommy Davidson. I mean, these guys were juggernauts. I mean, so you had to sort of find your way. And so Keenan would bring out this huge box of just wigs and noses and just funny shit, right? And so he picks up this blonde wig and says, yo, Jamie, throw this on and do that character. So I throw it on. Then David Alan Greer says, oh, JJ, when you're doing it, you got to say, I'll rock your world. And so I put that in there. And it was this other girl. Her name was AJ Sanders. She was from Texas. She guest starred on Different World a little bit. And at that time, we were like doing stand up with each other. And she said, don't forget to say, hey, for real though. Hey, for real though. And so that's what made that character, you know, it took off. And so the reason that was significant, because it was only 22 minutes of programming. So you got to think about it. You got Jim Carrey eating, you got Damon eating. It ain't no time. So when Wanda popped off, I was like, let's ride this shit. You know, so we were riding the Wanda thing out, but then it backfired on me. Like, I remember, what's that group? In Vogue. In Vogue shows up. I'm in the Wanda character, but you know, In Vogue is hot. I'm trying to see I'm trying to see what they doing later on. You know what I'm saying? So I'm in the Wanda dress, like, where y'all going? And they looked at me like, what? I said, just trying to figure out, you know, where y'all hanging. And they all whispered with each other and they just left. Like, I was just like, I'm just standing there in the fucking hills. Like, okay. Fuck, I guess that didn't go too well and shit. So then I'm still working on my music because I would notice all of the music acts that were coming. We had some of the biggest acts. We have Public Enemy, you had Heavy D, you had all of these great acts. And so one day Teddy Riley, who was my hero at the time, New Jack Swing, shows up and he's doing his thing with Guy and check, baby, 1, 2, 3, 4, check, baby. It's called the rump. They doing the rump shake. I'm like, damn. So I go to my room and I'm getting ready to do the Wanda thing, but they say Teddy getting ready to leave. So I run in my room, grab my cassette tape, get that bitch of my demo. I want that shit to start right on the beat. And so I'm running to go get Teddy Riley. Teddy's further up in the hall. So I'm running like, Teddy! He turns around and sees me, a bra, size 32 shoe, you know, and he hadn't seen the Wanda character yet. Because it was new. So I'm barely, Teddy! Like slow motion, Teddy! Teddy Riley! I need you, man. I said, Teddy. I do music. He said, impossible. And he walked out. He was like, get the fuck out of here with that shit, man. And so at that time, it was a blessing and a curse, but I never gave up on the music because I knew at some point it would happen. And even Keenan warned me. He said, Fox, you know, you got to be careful because I don't think a comic can do music and have people believe it. So I was like, fuck, you know, what do I do? And he wasn't being mean-spirited. He just wanted me to stay focused on one thing. Because at that time, you know, I think Eddie did Party All the Time, which I thought was hot. But it wasn't like a thing where... Don't front on that Party All the Time. That Party All the Time was the shit. Don't fuck around. You smoke enough weed, you... Hey. So that was my dilemma. So what I started doing with that party list, I started throwing parties for people that were in music. So I would just throw a party. I would throw a party and have Snoop come by. And I built a studio in the back of my little small house, and I'd throw a party. And I'd say, Snoop, man, leave me 8-16 bars. For sure, cuz. I got you, cuz. And now, so every time I throw a party, like, I would have music guys come and drop some music in my little studio. And then that sort of became the thing. And till one day, I, and this is a backstory to this. Like the way I got everybody to come to the party was weird. Remember Puff back in the 90s, right? There's nobody like that. Nobody bigger than Puff. Nobody bigger than that. Puff would come to LA and we couldn't even get in our own clubs. And I mean, it was crazy. I said, can I get, nah, man, Puff here. So I remember jumping out of a town car, because that's when the town car game was cool. So I was in a town car, and I jumped out with a camera, like a big-ass, like, camera. Like, yo, Puff, we should document this shit. He said, what's up, Playboy? I said, you got to document this shit, man, all this great shit you doing. Let me film this. And he was like, yeah, let him through. So I'm marching again. Oh, shit, Puff in this motherfucker. I got up in this motherfucker. But the camera was big as fuck. You know, it was that big Sony camera. It ain't like your little camera phone, you know, unintrusive. It was a big shit. I had to fix the light and shit. And I said, Puff, do that again. Let me change the battery and shit. Let me capture that shit again. So during that time, I was following Puff, and all this great shit was happening. I remember being at the Beverly Hills Hotel with Puffy, and it was amazing. And while he was by the pool, I saw Dr. Ruth. I said, Miss Ruth, doctor, there's a guy by the name of Sean P. Diddy Combs. Could you come with me? I'd love to get you on camera with him. You know, it's part of my party thing, right? I'm doing. She said, oh, yes, I know Puffy. Oh, yeah, I love Puffy. Oh, Puffy, 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 Puffy. So Puff comes over and brings Dr. Ruth over to the pool. And at that pool, check this out. I call myself the Black Forrest Gump because I'm always there when it's fly. Heavy D, God bless, is at the pool. Andre Harrell is at the pool. They're listening to the demo. Tell me what this song is. Dum, dun, 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 prompt, kick-a-doo-doo, kick-a-doo. It was Beyonce's record. And they were saying, that's the single she should go with. So I'm there when they picked that record. I'm like, holy shit, got that on camera. Now.
Where is that video?
I got it all, bro.
What?
Small fee.
That's great.
I'm gonna put this shit on YouTube. Hell no, man. Come see this shit. So now Dr. Ruth is dancing with Puffy. Oh, Puffy, Puffy, Puffy. And then Dr. Ruth does a tutelage of something that was, you know, in her field. And the young folks didn't understand. Yo, whose grandmother is this talking about? So that was weird. And then all of a sudden, here comes Demi Moore. Demi Moore's walking up. I got my camera. And then there's some young kid with her. And I said, yo, Puff, who the young dude? He said, oh, that's Ashton Kutcher. So I have all this on tape, right? So it was just all of these great things, great people happening. I was there. It was Black Forrest Gump. I'm there, right? And then finally, Puffy, because he was the king of the party, but I was also the prince of the party. So it was a little bit of a battle because it was the East Coast, West Coast thing before y'all knew about it. So Puff throws a party in Philly. The party is incredible. Puff is standing, you know, somehow he would figure out a way to be standing on top of everybody. Just look at my subjects. Suckle me, my suckles. My subject suckled the champagne from me. He was just, is that too much? He was, or he was like, please. He was like the dude from 300. Oh, yes. You must bow down to, you know, he was like that dude, right? So the party's fucking crazy. And then Puff comes up, said, yo, Playboy, you love this party? I said, I love it. He said, this party cost me $1.5 million. I'm like, what the fuck? You spent $1 million on this party? He said, yeah, Playboy. I said, Puff, no disrespect, but I could throw you a party in L.A. for $400 that will rival this motherfucker. And Puff got mad at me. Really, because Puff, you know, that's my guy. That's my idol when it comes to any of this. He's like, yo, don't ever disrespect. I said, Puff, I'm not disrespecting, man. I'm just telling you, you know, because I'm young in my career. I'm just saying, you come to L.A., I got you. So about 8 weeks later, Puff shows up to L.A., calls me on a Saturday. Yo, Playboy, make that shit happen. I said, I'm on it. Got my two phones that now have those 800 numbers in it that I've accumulated other people. And in that phone, I was always great with this. I called 225 people. But those 225 people are in tune and in sync with Puff. No haters. We are there to celebrate him. I don't want any problems for him. About 3 hours later, I said, Puff, where you at? The party is fever pitch. He shows up, you know, it's fucking Coming to America type shit. It was fucking, you know, that motherfucker Puff, hey, he got SUVs and shit, and they throwing roses, all kinds of shit, right? And glitter and shit, it's crazy. Farnsworth Bentley had a fucking umbrella and shit. Which was fucking great, like, oh, you got an umbrella. I said, who the dude with the umbrella? This is fucking crazy, right? So they come to the house, and I got a very small house, but when he walked in, he went, hey, that's the girl on that TV show, and that's the dude on them. I said, yeah, they're all here. We're all friends. We all hang out. I said, but look, let's tally up the money. Look on that table right there. That's Kentucky Fried Chicken. I just put it in a nice bowl. Look at that. That's Coca-Cola. I put it in a pitcher. We're at $208. We got money to burn, Puff. Money to burn. So the party's in fucking incredible. I ain't gonna front. And then we even played basketball. We were playing basketball, and I had the people that were playing basketball. We're not gonna foul Puffy. We're gonna make sure. No, because if you think at that time, Puff, I mean, he was responsible for a lot of shit. I mean, Jodeci, Mary J. Blige, all these people. So we're playing basketball. But you know what was the most gangster shit while we playing basketball?
What?
Farnsworth Bentley walked onto the court with a sandwich. He just walks on the court and says, you need to eat. And we all waited. It was like, this one, eat. You haven't eaten. You're running a company. These motherfuckers ain't doing shit. Eat. And we was like, that's the most baller shit in the world. When's the last time you go into the hole and somebody stick a sandwich in your mouth? So that was crazy. And then I said, Puff, I want you to look at this. Everybody's here because of you. A New York fitted baseball cap is $60 retail, but on your head it's priceless. We started playing his music. Dong, 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 dong. We yang.
Going nowhere. Go nowhere. Four.
You know what I'm saying? We got, hey. Don't you get light skinned in here, man? You better party. So everybody's having a great time, right? And Puff is like blown away. I said, yeah, man. And at that, let me break the room down for you. It's Puff in one room. I got Missy Elliott in the other room. Dun, 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 dun. So that's going on. It's a small house. And check this out. Standing against the wall, nobody knew who he was. He had a little green jumpsuit jacket on. Guess who it was? It was Jay-Z. Nobody knew. I said, what's up here?
It's a nice party. It's really nice party. I really appreciate it. It's crazy.
I said, yeah, man, Jay-Z, get in there, man. And then I'm walking to my garage because I had my little stowaway liquor back there. You know, I had a little stash. So I go in my garage, and coming out of the garage, it's a tall dude and a little short dude. And the little dude go, hey, yo, B. it's like this all the time, B? I said, what? Like you know, karaoke and girls? I said, yeah. Who are you? He said, we the Neptunes. My name is Pharrell. So that's how hot the party was. But there's all of this greatness, and then all of a sudden, this is how I get in the music business. A kid walks in, jaws busted, he's got a backpack on. Who is it? Kanye West. So when they say, that's Kanye, I said, first of all, what is a Kanye? And they say, he's about to be the next one. So I go up to him, I say, hey Mr. Kanye, every time somebody comes to my house, they have to perform. So he, right off the bat, freestyles something. I've never heard anything this incredible in my entire life. I said, dude, you the most incredible motherfucker I've ever heard. I said, why ain't you like, he says, and he goes, I got a song that I think that you will be good on. And I think we should try to go do the song. I said, you got a song for me? I said, well, you in luck, because I got my studio right in the back. Let's go get it popping. And I march back and, oh, shit, we about to do a record. So I march in the back, right? But, you know, I didn't know about hip-hop, because, see, I grew up on, like, R&B, where you had to have, you know, a certain outfit and shoulder pads in order to have a hit song. So he's explaining to me this song. He says, the song goes like this. She says she wants some Marvin Gaye, some Luther Vandross, a little Anita. I said, I got it. I'm in the booth. I got it. She says she wants some Marvin Gaye. Marvin Gaye. He said, what are you doing? I said, look here, young fella, you don't know nothing about no music. See, this real music. I got the R&B that thing. He goes, don't do that. He said, music is simple. You just sing it simple. So in my mind, I'm thinking, you know what? This song is whack. He's not going to make it. I'm just going to do it how he said, but this, it don't make sense. So I begrudgingly sung the song. After I sung the song and after that whole night, which was remarkable, I left and went and I did a bad movie. After I came back, about 8 weeks, 12 weeks later, my boy goes, you remember that song you said was whack? And you didn't think it was whack? I said, yeah. It's number one in the country. And we're in Miami while he's saying this at a club. I said, what? He taps the DJ on the shoulder and said, play that song. Are you gonna be? Oh. And I ran and grabbed the mic. That's me. I R&B the shit out of that motherfucker. And that's how I got into the music.
So I would be remiss if we did not get to this, but also the music, the training from your grandmother, that all came to a head in around 2003, 2004, when you met a man named Ray Charles. And in telling me how you channeled Ray and how you worked with him, we also want to talk about everybody's favorite person, Oprah, because she set you straight. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
So first of all, Ray Charles was amazing. And Taylor Hackford, who had wanted to do Ray Charles for years, who also did Officer and a Gentleman, who also did Devil's Advocate, who was like, he'd been waiting 20 years to get Ray Charles done. We meet each other. And it was a great experience. Here's where the music comes in. Taylor Hackman says, listen, I got a problem. I want to be able to shoot you. I want to be able to hold the frame, but I'm going to have to find somebody who knows how to play the piano in order to get this done. I said, you're in luck, bro. A lady by the name of Estelle Talley made sure that I had those tools so I could go across the tracks. I'm going across the tracks right now. So as we play, and I learned how to play all of Ray Charles's music, I wanted to make everything perfect. I wanted to be able to, that every note that you see, because sometimes you'll see a movie where it's about music and you can tell that someone's not playing. So I wanted to get that right. And then it was meeting Mr. Ray Charles. And when I went to see him at his studio, coming down the hallway is the great Ray Charles. And he walks up and says, hey, how are we doing, baby? Hey, good to see you, baby. And I was like, Mr. Charles, I just want to do the best I can to bring your story to light. And he said, hey, you know what? Let me tell you something. If you can play the blues, baby, you can do anything. Let's play the blues. So we sat down on dual pianos, and I played the blues with Ray Charles. Right? So there we are playing the blues, and we getting it. We good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then we moved into Thelonious Monk. I don't know what you know about music, but that's some dangerous, intricate territory. I can't remember the lick that we were playing. He moves into that, and all of a sudden, I hit a wrong note. He says, shit, why would you do that? And why the hell would you hit that note? And, you know, for his ears, you know, that's very sensitive, you know, because his ears is very magnified. I said, Mr. Charles, I'm so sorry. I just accidentally hit the note. And he said, that's what life is, taking the time out to hit the right notes. Hit the right notes. And I said, I'm on it. So then we played it. I got it right. And he goes, eh, that's it. The kids got it. And he walked off. And so that's how that journey began. Then it was a matter of finding the young Ray Charles. Because when you're putting together a character, you have to be careful that you don't do it as a impersonation. The great thing about being on A Living Color with Keenan and all of those guys, every time they did a character, you knew everything about that soul. Every time you saw Jim Carrey do a character, every time you seen Damon do a character, it was part of the soul you were laughing at. It wasn't just some veneer. It was part of the soul. So I'm like, how do I get the soul? So I go to Quincy Jones's place. And I meet Quincy, go to his house. Hey, man, shit, come on in, man. Hell yeah, baby, shit. Ray Charles, man. Ray Charles was the son of a bitch, man. He was amazing, man. The music, man, he's something else, Jamie. Come on in, baby. And I walk in, Quincy's house, and there's the records. You see that? That's 54 million records. Michael Jackson, baby. Yeah, that's the shit right there. That's the cat's meow, Jamie. And to sit there and listen to Quincy talk about shit, man. You know, we were doing music, man. Ray, man, he was so smart, man. He was smarter than all of us, and he dressed nice. You know, we had zoot suits and shit on when we were in Seattle, man. But he was always dressed nice, and he commanded everything, man. I said, well, Mr. Jones, first of all, I love you and what you do. I need to find the young Ray Charles. Shit, hold on, man. Let me find something for you. And he goes and he grabs a cassette tape. And he says, maybe you could find something on this tape. And then I said to myself, where in the fuck am I going to find a cassette player in 2003, right? So I went to Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Or some, I don't know for sure if it was Enterprise. I don't want to put it out there like that. But I went to some rent-a-car place, and there was a cassette tape player. So I popped the cassette in, and for those of you who are with me who are seasoned, you know what I'm about to say. You'll know who this person is. When I put the tape in, I hear, hi, this is Dinah Shore from The Dinah Shore Show. And two very wonderful musicians here today, Mr. Kenny Rogers and Mr. Ray Charles. And in the back, you hear the young Ray. Hey, you know what, Donna? I'm just so happy to be here. You know, the fact that you know my music is just so grand. I'm just so happy to be here today. And I can't wait to show my music. And then as he's talking, she said, she asked the question, talk about the drugs, Ray. And there was a pause for about 5 or 6 seconds. And that young Ray Charles was not frustrated, but uneasy with that question. Because he was dealing with that out in public. He was writing and talking about his struggle. So he began to fidget. So what I did was I took the DNA of that to build the character that when he's doing music in the movie, he's in complete control. But when he is confronted with responsibility, you did this with the drugs, you did this with your wife, he would. So that's how the wonderful journey of Ray Charles was built.
And Before we get to the Q&A, we got to talk about Oprah.
Well, what happened was is that I was still a young, gregarious individual. When we were up for the Oscar, I didn't take it seriously because I thought that there's no way I would win that. And so I used it as a method to party. Like, I'm nominated. Oh, shit. Break out the champagne. What we doing? It's crazy. And I remember, like, having paparazzi for the first time. And I remember just, like, going absolutely nuts. I think I went on the Golden Globes, to the Golden Globes, where maybe there was some champagne involved. And I remember being on the red carpet, being very sort of, like, wrong. I was really wrong. I was disrespectful to the process. And I remember the young lady that I went with, a really good friend of mine, we get on a red carpet. We were nominated for three categories. So we were going, three, yeah, three, baby, three. And my publicist called, said, what are you doing? I said, what? He said, you see how embarrassing this is? And I was like, damn. He says, you got a chance. He says, but it is, you know, you got to walk a certain way, you know. And then all of a sudden I get the call. And I pick the phone up one day and I hear, hi, Jamie Foxx. Who's this? It's Oprah. Oprah Winfrey, Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx, you're blowing it. And I was like, what? She says, you're blowing it. She says, because you really have a great opportunity to do something that is wonderful, and the character that you played is wonderful and touched so many people. So she said, I want to take you somewhere. And she took me back to Quincy Jones's house. I go to Quincy Jones' house, and he says, hey, shit, come on in, man. You're blowing it. Shit. But when I walked in, there was a party going on, and there were people that I had seen growing up, there were actors and actresses that were all standing there waiting to meet me and say, great job, and say, good luck. Some of the actors and actresses looked like they hadn't had a suit on in a while. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It was touching. Like, it was like, you know, maybe hadn't worked in a while. And they were like, we just want to let you know that it means something. And then all of a sudden, Oprah says, okay, are you ready to meet the person that you're here to talk to? I said, yeah. He's right over there. And standing in a tuxedo is Sidney Poitier. And I walk up to Sidney Poitier and he goes, I saw you one time. You were at a party. Do you remember that? I started crying. I said, yes, sir, Mr. Poitier, I remember. Watching your performance, I grew 2 inches. You were phenomenal. And I was like, Mr. Poitier, thank you so much. He says, I give you one thing. I said, what is that? Responsibility. And I was like, oh, shit. Thank you. I'm calling like, yo, no after parties. No after parties. Okay. And then that night, Sidney Poitier spoke and Oprah Winfrey spoke. And Quincy Jones spoke, and Don Rickles told jokes. And I watched all of these beautiful, magnificent people rally behind me. I got my shit together. I took my daughter to the Oscars. And that night was a moment where everything came together. Everybody was... It was a magical moment. And then for my daughter, waiting to hear my name called out, my daughter who was 10 at the time, she says, Dad, I just want to let you know, even if you don't win, you're still a great actor. So you melt in your seat, and then they call out my name, and then there I go. And it was a lot of things going on. It was a wonderful time. Also, Charlize Theron gave me the trophy. Which was interesting because years ago, I saw her in some eatery or whatever, and I was going to go talk to her, and Andre Harrell was like, yo, young brother, you can't talk to her. I was like, why? I'm just going to say her. You have to have a golden statue in order to talk to her. Funny how things work out. And then that night, man, it was magical, and I thank my grandmother and everybody was great. But I kept it real though, because I didn't go to the Vanity Fair party. I said, after we win, I'm in the clear, right? So I threw my own little after party. I didn't put my name on it, but I had my boy throw it in his name so I could go celebrate the way I wanted to celebrate. So you see all these SUVs headed to the Vanity Fair, then I pull over here to the little joint, baby. We turned that thing absolutely out. Everybody was marching in there. And I just, you know, and it was, these were people that I had stayed in contact with since the first time I went on stage doing that comedy in front of those folks in the Regency. Since the first time I went on stage and I did my first Mike Tyson impersonation. And when I did that impersonation in Hood back at that time, the crowd didn't laugh.
Why?
Because Mike Tyson was in the audience. And I heard the dude say, hey, yo, Mike is in here. I'm like, oh, shit. I'm like, you know, I got immediate gas. I'm, oh, shit. I said, shit. And it was a black girl in front like, what you gonna do, Jamie? You gonna tell your little joke? You scared? Shut up. Goddamn, shut your motherfucking ass up. And this is when Mike was knocking motherfuckers out for nothing. You know what I'm saying? The dude said, yo, Mike is in here. I said, shit. And then he goes, Mike should do the joke. And that shit better be funny. So I do the joke. I think it was about him going to Kentucky Fried Chicken. So I don't know. It was like he was Mike Tyson going through the drive-thru. Hi. And no, he worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that's the voice you heard in the box. Hi, welcome to Kentucky Fried Chicken. May I take your order? So whatever, I got a standing ovation. When I came off the stage, Mike walks up. There he is. Poof, hit me in the chest. Almost caved my sternum in. Heavy-handed, motherfucker. But some of those same people that were there were at my party. We hung out. As a matter of fact, the Oscar flew out of my hands with some of the homies taking pictures. Like, yo, get this. And people were smoking weed. I mean, the weed. I mean, it was crazy. It was like, it was the party to be at. And I think my Oscar got high because it was, I just saw my Oscar wander through the party off the base like, what the fuck is going on, man? I know Denzel didn't do this kind of shit, man. What? Hey, man, give me my bass, man. Shit. What the fuck?
Jamie Foxx.
I gotta throw this in here too. Make sure you come see my new stand-up. My new stand-up is absolutely incredible. Some great shit. You wanna see it. It's unedited. I'm sort of curtailing things. Curtail.
So some audience Q&A. I'm not sure if the mics have already been passed around. We have one for
You said how you deal with the jealousy? No. You know what? I think things have changed now. I think people are more jealous now because you have an avenue to show your jealousy. Like, you know, back in the day, you didn't have social media. You know, you watched something and it impacted you in a way, and you went on. Now, art suffers a little bit when you do something artistic and somebody will switch it around, and the next thing you know, it flies in some sort of, I don't know, some sort of internet world where you can't really figure things out. So it wasn't a lot of jealousy at that time. It was a lot of camaraderie, but at the same time, we were jockeying for position, but we were all happy for each other. While if you look at nowadays, you know, you'll see a great article, and in the comments, you'd be like, oh, what the fuck? This is crazy. So it's a different time. You know, it was a different time back then. You were happy to see a young Chris Rock or Adam Sandler, or I'm sitting with Jim Carrey in his office while he's writing Pet Detective. And then he calls me one day, hey, Jamie, it's Jim, man. Hey, I want you to come on to show you some stuff. And I go over there, and he shows me dailies from his movie Pet Detective. And I shook his hand. I said, he said, why are you shaking my hand? I said, I'll never be able to shake your hand this way for a long time because you're about to blow the fuck up. So, it was different. Today's world, you know, you got to, you know, navigate a little bit more, but I always say less jealousy because some of the artistic things are being sort of trounced. Imagine Prince trying to grow up in this world with memes. You know, he'd never want to wear his shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I'm saying? I'm gonna put on a little, you know, a one piece. He go do his thing. And then they fucking kill him. You know what I'm saying? So it's no. Am I right? I mean, there's no way. I remember my daughter showed me a picture of Rihanna. She went to the Met Ball, right? And I was like, oh, this is great. But I love how she put the pizza in the back of the dress. That's an odd choice, but I kind of get. And I didn't know what a meme is. Dad, that's a meme. I said, what is that? A meme. Said, what? There's actually not a pizza there, Dad. I said, then why is it? It's every picture I see, there's a pizza in her dress. I said, no, that's just how people fuck with her. I said, oh, so you know what I'm saying? It's like, so now sometimes you don't get, you lose a little bit of, you know, people coloring outside the lines. They don't do it no more. Like when the last person you saw, you're like, oh shit. You know, I said, I don't know, fuck it.
I think we can get another question in.
How is it to work with two?
Oh, we could do both.
Well, Tupac was amazing, but you got to understand, this is what was interesting about all of us. We were young, man. We were 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. So we were young. So we did a lot of shit before. I mean, like, I would hang out. I was there the night Tupac was killed. We were all in Vegas, you know, just having a great time. That moment was, you know, earth-shattering. I was there when he was outside the Comedy Act, the Comedy Store, just, you know, rapping and doing his thing. And then when he came to our show, he was just an amazing talent, amazing light, and it's great to be able to have that footage that we can look back on and say, wow, you know, some fantastic time.
You got one right here.
You can hear me?
Yeah.
All right,
use the mic.
Yeah, right here?
Yeah.
So, can you Milly Rock? No, I'm joking.
That's not work.
Oh, it is. Oh, my fault.
That's a comedian right there.
Yo, I'm right here.
Okay, I see you, bro. Shit, just come on up, just so we can fucking see you. Just fucking come up.
You got it?
Yeah.
I bet. You want me to get closer?
Yeah, good shit. Let them see you, bro. come on stage, man. Just get up there. Just get up there. Look, just come on stage. There you go. Come up. Shit, fuck it. See? That's what I'm talking about. It was good. Young ass man.
It's your question, man.
Oh, so like, you know.
You can tell he got the light, right? He got the light. He gonna be something. Give it up. What's your name, bro?
Salif. Salif. My fault. I can't.
Give it up for Salif, man.
Thank you. So I'm trying to be an actor myself.
Really? I mean, I didn't get that at all.
That's
you
good.
You got it. You got it. What's the question? What do you think?
So you think that impulsiveness that you had led you to those opportunities to make it?
Yeah, you have to, and I'll tell this because you're what, 19, 20?
22.
So you're 22. Imagine if we had what you had back in the day.
Okay.
Like, if I had social media, I'd be fucking crazy. The reason that I don't do as much because I feel like that is your median, so sometimes I feel weird by being on there too much. Look at me. I've already done my shit. But you have an opportunity now. Right now, you can take whatever this is right now, and this could be the genesis of your moment.
Right.
So this is your time to do whatever you want to do right now.
All right.
Do whatever you want to do right now. Sure. I say your name again? Salif.
Salif.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Salif! There you go. That's all it takes, man.
Oh, no, we're messing up.
Jamie?
All right, we have a mic right over here.
Yeah. Hey, Mom.
Who is the actor that you most admire, and what is the historic role that you would like to play next?
I would say the actor that I admire the most because he's been to my house and he's so incredible is Denzel Washington. And Denzel did something fantastic. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be interviewing him again on this new show it's called Off Script. It's where I interview all of the great movie actors. But Denzel came to my house, and I do these things. That party that I talk about, I continue to do those. And sometimes we'll have We'll have contrast parties where I'll have someone like Denzel come over. We'll have a dinner, and then I'll call all of the young actors and actresses, the Michael B. Jordan, the young Tyrese, all that, and we're all sitting at the table while he tells us or gives us information about how to get things done and his backstory. The contrast of the story was I had a mariachi band. I know that sounds weird. I know it sounds weird, but at my house, the new house, I had this a guy who runs my grounds. His name is Manny, and I'm outside one day, and I hear Manny singing. I'm like, Manny, you sing? Oh, yes, I have a mariachi band, Mr. Jamie. I said, God damn it, that's nice. I want you to bring your mariachi band and perform for Denzel Washington. He went, what? I said, yeah, bring him. I said, I don't give a shit, bring him. And Manny brought his mariachi band, right? So as Denzel is doing his thing, I said, Denzel, we got a mariachi band. He said, a mariachi band? All right, okay. Mariachi band? All right, okay. So you got a mariachi band. I said, yeah. And what was interesting about Manny's story was that Manny had a supervisor. I don't know, when your house get bigger, I guess you had to have a supervisor. Guy, I don't know what the fuck that was, but he was the supervisor of the grounds. And his name was, I can't say his name. Because this is live, right?
This is live.
This is the video?
Yep.
Ah, shit. I don't know how to tell the story. It's a great story. Let's call him Marty. So a guy named Marty was the supervisor. And Marty, when I first moved into my house, I was having a party, and Marty walked up and says, how many parties are we going to have? I'm like, I thought about this shit. He said, I just want to know, because of the integrity of the house, I want to maintain that. I was like, oh, shit. And he walked off. I threw my weed. And he walked out. So he made me feel uncomfortable in my house. So I'd be partying and stuff, and he'd be up on the balcony just looking down. I tell everybody, put the music down. Man, put the drinks on. Fuck. So he made me feel uncomfortable. Marty did. So when I had Manny, he was giving Manny a hard time. But anyway, so when Manny got the opportunity to come do the Denzel thing, I mean, I said, Denzel, I got a mariachi band that's about to come out. So all of a sudden, we open the doors, and there's Manny with 85 mariachi, like the dancers, the whole nine, and he's standing at the top of the stairs, and I said, Manny, hit it. And he said, Guadalajara, 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 Guadalajara. And the shit went up in flames. I mean, people was, and then motherfuckers marched and shit. It was amazing. And it was a wonderful moment to have Denzel break down all of what he broke down, the mariachi band, which I call my contrast parties, and then after it was over, standing on the top of the stairs was fucking Marty. And he fired Manny. Yeah, he fired Manny. So Manny comes to me the next day. He says, Mr. Jamie, he fired me. I said, Manny? I said, you're not fired, because you're a great person. So I ended up firing Marty, and Manny became my guy. And Manny has played mariachi for my daughters and all my different parties. And he also played on the soundtrack of a new movie that I did called All-Star Weekend. He's on the soundtrack. So Manny's my guy. Thank you for allowing me to get into that story. And also, with those parties that I throw, if you ever get a chance, like I said, to check some of the stuff out, we're going to do. I do, like I said, the contrast parties. One cool contrast, we had the whole Olympic basketball team at the house, other than DeAndre Jordan and Harrison Barnes, but the whole Olympic basketball team. And then I had my man that does the magic, David Blaine. So imagine the Olympic basketball team in a room and David Blaine doing magic. And I learned something really interesting about black people. Like, when the level of magic is too high, it scared the shit out of us. We're like, oh, shit, he did something. And Kevin Durant went, oh, hell no, man. That's sorcery, man. I don't know about that, man. That's sorcery, man. Man, that's a witch doctor shit. Denzel, I mean, as I go back to that.
All right, guys. So we got a question. This side. first of all, I want to thank you so much for the projection of Ray Charles.
Thank you, bro.
But I want to also say, didn't I see you on Robert Townsend? That's where you first blew up?
Was I on Robert Townsend?
Yes.
I wasn't on Robert Townsend, but Robert Townsend was one of the guys who, like, we looked up to. Like, it was Robert Townsend, it was Keenan, it was Arsenio Hall. All of these guys were, all of those great movies that you were seeing, like Eddie Murphy's Raw or Eddie Murphy's Coming to America, all those guys had, you know, a strong hand in that. And Eddie, to this day, I see Eddie and I say, Eddie, we need you, man. We want to see you come back out and do something. He's, now you want to talk about, when it comes to comedians, there's no one who touches that guy. We all trying to chase him.
Thank you so much for that question. Thank you, everybody. Make some noise for yourself. Some great questions.
Give it up for Jacques.
Before we get out of here, you are co-hosting Beach Azam with your daughter.
Yes, man.
She just signed the CAA. Can you talk about how happy
it is? I got to tell you, I'm very happy about my daughter, Corinne Marie Fox, who is the most well-adjusted kid in our business. Like, you know, in our business, it could go all kinds of ways. She's always been, like, smart. She's always kept me in check, too, because she doesn't think that I never grow up. And so she's always like, Dad, you got to chill.
What about your feet? Talk about your feet.
Oh, yeah. And even with my shoes, I got on the appropriate shoes today. But even when I wear the wrong shoe, she'd be like, Dad, what do you have on? And I remember one day I had on, like, a stylist gave me some kind of it had a buckle and a zipper and my initials. And she was like, Dad, what the hell are you doing? And I said, baby, it's the style. She said, Dad, you can't wear those kind of shoes. You're too old for that. You got old feet. I was like, well, yeah, you have old feet. You have feet. You have, like, civil rights feet. Like, you got feet that you should be marching with. So she always keeps me in check, and I'm always embarrassing her. But something great came along. This show that I produce and I host called Beat Shazam, where you figure out the greatest songs and you win $1 million. Fox was like, who do we get for the DJ? And my daughter went in on her own steam and wowed them. And so this year, when you get a chance, on May 29th, make sure you check out Beat Shazam, and Corinne Marie Fox is my DJ. And that's how you keep it in the family.
Jamie, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Please make some noise for Jamie Foxx.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Jane Rosenthal. Thank you, Tribeca. Thank you, Jacques. I appreciate it.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilm.com.